The reading is taken from 1 Kings chapter 4, beginning at verse 20. The people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate, they drank, and they were happy. And Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt. These countries brought tribute and were Solomon's subjects all his life. Solomon's daily provisions were 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 head of stall-fed cattle, 20 of pasture-fed cattle, and 100 sheep and goats, as well as deer, gazelles, roebucks, and choice fowl. For he ruled over all the kingdoms west of the river, from Tiphsah to Gaza, and had peace on all sides. During Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, lived in safety, each man under his own vine and fig tree. Solomon had 4,000 stalls for chariot horses and 12,000 horses. The district officers, each in his month, supplied provisions for King Solomon and all who came to the king's table. They saw to it that nothing was lacking. They also brought to the proper place their quotas of barley and straw for the chariot horses and the other horses. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than any other man, including Ethan the Ezrahite, wiser than Heman, Calcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahal. And his fame spread to all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. He described plant life from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He also taught about animals and birds, reptiles and fish. Men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. May God bless his reading.
Thank you. There was a headline that I read in big bold print, and it said, "There are 11 countries in the world that are at war." I thought, interesting, but I thought there was a lot more than that. Then I read the headline again. It actually said, "There are 11 countries in the world that are not at war." Interesting. Now, they're using that "at war" in a very wide sense. Countries who have troops anywhere, who are involved in military action anywhere outside their own borders. Only 11 countries in the world where that is not happening. Can't remember who they all were. But that's astounding, isn't it? And we know actually that there are dozens and dozens of countries in the world where there really is conflict, war in the way that we would all know it. Again, I don't know how many, round about 70, I think, could be counted around the world at the moment where that is happening. And it makes you realize, doesn't it, how incredibly privileged we are as a nation. We are a complaining bunch, aren't we? As British people, it's kind of what we do for a hobby. Yet the blessings we have are magnificent in so many ways. You don't have to travel too far, actually, to appreciate that, do you? Appreciate what it means to have the rule of law, to have basically a sound infrastructure, to have a pretty well-ordered society. All of us who are here tonight are immensely, immensely privileged. But imagine you could take our situation here in Britain and multiply it, and multiply it, and multiply it, to see it as many, many times better than it is now. So we have a genuinely exemplary government. We have profound international respect. There is affluence for everybody, and there is real justice for everyone. Do you imagine living in a place like that? Can you imagine it? It might sound like heaven, but what it's actually describing is Israel under King Solomon. Because that's the kind of picture that is painted for us here of Solomon's reign. Chapter 1 and 2 of 1 Kings tell us how Solomon came to power after the death of his father David. Chapter 3 tells us of Solomon's amazing encounter with God and the request that Solomon makes of God. But now in chapter 4, we're given a snapshot of what life was like in Israel when Solomon's reign got underway. And it is staggering. In fact, the author can hardly find enough words to express himself here. We have it summarized there in verse 20 and 21. The people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate and they drank and they were happy. That's how these people were described. We have it again in verse 25. During Solomon's reign, Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel from Dan to Beersheba, Land's End to John O'Groats in Israelite terms, lived in safety, everyone under his own vine and his own fig tree. It's a glorious kingdom that is presented to us. And as you read this presentation of Solomon's reign, there are a number of things that are very particularly highlighted. Things that will lead us into how I want to apply this. In fact, my daughter sat next to me when it was being read, said, "Did you choose this reading?" But there is an application. Because here there is a king, and here there is a kingdom, and here there are people. There is the glory of a king, there is the glory of a kingdom, and there is the privilege of the citizens. So do you notice in this reading the glory of the king? Four aspects of glory that are repeated for us here. First of all, there is wisdom. Back in chapter 3, remember, God comes to Solomon, "What do you want?" And Solomon says, "There's only one thing I want. Your servant is here among you, the people you have chosen, a great people too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong, for who is able to govern this great people of yours?" That's Solomon's prayer back in chapter 3 for wisdom. And God pours it out on Solomon in staggering abundance. So verses 1 to 16 from 16 following of chapter 3, the tragic case of the two women and the dead baby. It's a terrible dilemma. Two unverifiable but contradictory accounts. Who is telling the truth? But Solomon has God's wisdom to judge. But we also see his wisdom in the first 19 verses of chapter 4. And I could have asked for this to be read as well, and that would really have done it. Here is a picture of Solomon's court. But it is a picture of his brilliant wisdom in administration. It's estimated between 4,000 and 5,000 people worked in Solomon's palace. But it's a symptom of his amazing organizational wisdom. Remember that in the Bible, wisdom is not so much the ability to know as the ability to do. Wisdom in the Bible is knowledge that is profoundly put into practical action. Solomon is the wise man here par excellence. So there is his wisdom. Then there is his power. Verse 21, Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river Euphrates to the land of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt. Those countries brought tribute and were Solomon's subjects all of his life. Here we have Solomon's vastly increasing influence. Don't know if you have maps at the back of your Bibles, and if you do, whether one of them has Solomon's kingdom. But it's amazing, because there we see Israel as we know it, and it's tiny, because Solomon's reign has extended way up north and way out east, begun to move south. All these countries then came and paid tribute to Solomon and were subject to him. That is a powerful king. That is a king who now is not only ruling a nation, but is ruling an empire. Wisdom and power, and then there's vast wealth. So conspicuous again in these readings. Solomon's daily provisions, verse 22, 30 cores of the finest flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 head of store-fed cattle, 20 of pasture-fed cattle. Don't understand a word of that, but it's a lot of stuff, isn't it, that Solomon has. It's magnificent. If you were to read on in chapter 10, you'd find it even more so. Now, we have to admit that there's something a little problematic about this. This is conspicuous consumption, and we're right to be wary of it. Back in Deuteronomy 17, Moses told the people of the kind of king that they were to appoint, and he laid out a blueprint for Israelite kingship. And one thing it said is he must not be lavishly rich. And yet here we have Solomon. And so the wise reader reads this with a note of caution, and I think does see here some of the seeds of later problems. However, when we read this in its own right, it's very, very clear that the writer at this stage is overwhelmingly positive about it. He doesn't want to thinking, but we know what happened next. He sees this actually as a fulfillment of some of God's promises. Chapter 3 and verse 13, God says, "Moreover, I will give you what you have not asked for, both wealth and honor." So God has promised him this. It's in line with Old Testament expectations. If there is honor and obedience to God, then there will be material blessing. And it's almost inevitable that somebody with that much power and influence is going to become wealthy. And we need to see that the people as a whole were blessed through this. There was a genuine trickle down from Solomon's wealth to the benefit of the people. So we need to let the account stand as it does at this stage rather than criticize it. And then there was honor. Solomon receiving great praise from everywhere. Verse 21, these countries brought tribute and were Solomon's subject. That tribute was not just material. It was that sense of wonder at his wisdom and his power. Again, what God promised, because you haven't asked for anything other than wisdom, I'm going to give you wealth and honor. So here is King Solomon, a great king because of his faithfulness to God, enjoying wisdom and power and wealth and honor. And I don't know, but there may well have been songs composed by court musicians in praise of this great king. And on the basis of this chapter, one of their songs might go like this: "O King, you are worthy to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." Does it remind you of anything? Because there is a king in the Bible who is praised in exactly those terms. Those are the words of the Song of Heaven to the Lord Jesus himself. Everything that's said of Solomon in this concentrated fashion in this chapter is picked up in the praises of the book of Revelation. In a loud voice they were saying, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." And that shows us, of course, where this description is pointing. Solomon is presented as an ideal king, at this stage, as a model king. But what he does is propel our minds forward to the model, the ideal king, who is one day going to come. And that's what we're to be taken up with here. We see this ancient king, And we're to say, but do you know, in its absolute fullness, that is our king. Our king is all of the things that Solomon was described of here, but to the nth degree. Jesus said himself, something greater than Solomon was here as he spoke about his ministry. So are we speaking about wisdom? Then King Jesus is wisdom personified. In him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Is it power? He is the King of kings and he is the Lord of lords. Is it wealth? All the nations are his. Is it honor? Well, King Jesus has the praise of all creation. Angels, thousands upon thousands, 10,000 times 10,000, every creature in heaven and earth and under the earth. They see the real greatness of the real king. With one profound difference, of course. Solomon wins power through military might, political strength, personal gifting. King Jesus wins his power through death on a cross. So the praise of heaven is not worthy is the king to receive power and wealth, but worthy is the lamb who was slain. Can you blame anybody at first for not understanding where the cross fitted in to the life and ministry of Jesus? Poor old Peter, who in a sense has just realized that he's confronted with a king far greater than Solomon. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then this king says to him, and my next steps are to a cross. Surely we sympathize with his failure to understand. But that is how it works. The cross as the victory place that led to the greatest glory of the greatest king. But nevertheless, what we have here is a king. What we worship is a king whose glory far outstrips Solomon. That's what we're about tonight as we worship King Jesus. But then notice the greatness of the kingdom as we look at the nation here. We're told about its geographical size. We mentioned that already. But we're also very clearly told about its population. Verse 20, the people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. Straightway, we recognize those words, don't we? They point us back and they point us forward. They point us back because that was the promise to Abraham. One day, he's told, your descendants will be as numerous as the sand on the seashore. In fact, all of the promises to Abraham are being fulfilled here in Solomon. That there would be a land for him. That the nations would be blessed through Abraham's descendants. And he would have many descendants himself. But particular attention is drawn here to the many descendants. That bit of the promise to Abraham is becoming a glorious reality in this time of King Solomon. So it points us back to the promises to Abraham. But with New Testament eyes, of course, it's propelling us forward. This idea of a kingdom that has grown and grown and expanding, people who are subject to God's king, again, we know where that leads us. It's pointing directly to the great King Jesus. Jesus himself who spoke about his kingdom in terms of this astonishing growth. You put a tiny mustard seed in the ground and you have a massive tree. He dares to say to his disciples, go into all the world and make disciples. This vision of a growing and ever-expanding church. And it's picked up again in Revelation. After this, I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people, and language standing before the throne and before the Lamb. See, this is the kingdom that you and I belong to. Just as this great king is ours, so is this ever-expanding kingdom. We forget it, don't we? Because we happen to live in a part of that kingdom that seems not to be growing. Though even here, in terms of true faith, the story, I think, is different from what the media would tell us. But we don't see this exponential growth in our city of Birmingham, do we? But around the world, and certainly in the ultimate sense, this is the kingdom of which we belong. kingdom of ever growing numbers. The glory of the king and the greatness of the kingdom. Then we're told in this chapter the joy of the citizens. I said earlier that one of the reasons we can see a rightness in Solomon's wealth at this point is that it did trickle down to the citizens. The three ways in which we see that, it was a rule of justice. The people of Israel had the amazing privilege of living in a society where righteousness ruled. That's what Solomon was demonstrating in that wise ruling back in chapter 3. And that's what the people are so excited about. Verse 28 of chapter 3, when all Israel heard the verdict the king had given, they held the king in awe because they saw that he had wisdom from God to administer justice. Because we live in a nation that is broadly governed justly, we don't get half of what that means. But you don't have to travel far from our borders, do you, around the world to know nations that just crave for justice, for leaders that will lead with honor and integrity and without corruption. But that's what the people vastly enjoyed in Solomon's day. His wisdom was exercised in the ability to act justly. And then we're told about their plenty. So the end of verse 20, they ate and drank and they were happy. Eat, drink, and be merry. Isn't it interesting? In the New Testament, the foolish farmer, for instance, is condemned for having that attitude. Eat, drink, and be merry. Here we're told it was a great privilege. The difference, of course, is because that foolish farmer was eating, drinking, and being merry without any reference to the God who gave it. Here are people acknowledging God the giver, and so they have the joy of eating and drinking and being happy. It's part of their daily blessing, justice and plenty and safety. That amazing little reference. They lived in safety, end of verse 25. Everyone under their own vine and their own fig tree. Amazing picture, isn't it? A little bit hard for us to understand. But if you could sit in those days under your own vine and fig tree, it meant that you were not at war. You didn't have anything to worry about. You had vines and fig trees because no marauding hordes from another nation had come in and robbed you. And you could sit there because you weren't off fighting with an army. So to sit under your own vine and fig tree was the way of saying, we are at peace. Now you could draw the application straight away, couldn't you? What is the joy of being a citizen of the nation of King Jesus? It is justice, actually, isn't it? It is to know that we live under the reign of the perfectly just King. That's how he deals with us now. Our lives are full of injustices, aren't they, actually? Of all kinds of things that betray us in different ways. It might be people, it might be circumstances, it might be our own bodies, whatever it is. They deal with us unjustly, but we serve a king who never, ever does. Others may misjudge us, but our king never does. And it's so in how he's going to deal with our enemies. There is justice to come. There is judgment to come, which leaves us free to forgive and to serve those who are against us. Why? Because our King is the perfect judge. Is it plenty? The New Testament almost fails in its vocabulary to try and tell us what we have. My God will supply all of your needs according to his riches in Christ Jesus. And is it safety? We have the greatest possible security being citizens of the nation of King Jesus. Our enemy is far greater, actually, than the natural enemies of Solomon's day. We don't fight against flesh and blood, but so is the security that comes from the king we serve. So you see, we've got a picture here of an extraordinary king who has an extraordinary kingdom and poured out on his citizens extraordinary blessings. And we can't do anything as New Testament believers and say, and that is our king. That's what our churches are about. That's what we're about as individual Christians. We live to honor and worship and serve that king. Who would want to be under any other king? How could we imagine that we could have any other allegiance? There were other times in Israel's history, weren't they, when they were so badly served. Indeed, the tragedy of Solomon is that in the end he would serve them badly. And then the people of Israel inevitably wanted to be under another king somewhere. But here, who would want to serve anybody else but King Solomon? We would say to ourselves, who will serve anybody else but King Jesus? And that's a challenge, isn't it, for all of us as individuals in just our regular daily lives, where the voices are constantly saying, come and serve me, come and give your allegiance to me, and we feel it so strong. We need to get a glimpse again of what it's like to be the citizens of a kingdom under this kind of king. And our churches are going to feel the pressure more and more to be serving another king, another word, to be bowing the knee to the kings of this world. We keep saying, there is no king like our king. There is no king who is greater and wiser and more powerful and whose citizens are more blessed. Trust you feel one of the most privileged people in the world to be a subject of the nation of King Jesus. And I hope you feel staggeringly privileged to be a part of the church of King Jesus, because there is no greater joy and no greater privilege in the whole world than that. We're going to sing about that kingship now. King of kings, majesty, God of heaven, living in me. It's a way of just expressing something of the astonishing joy and glory of that king.